All right. I'm a little late, but that's the way she goes. Joining me is the godfather of All Marine Radio, Bob Nielsen. Bob, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Max. How are you?
I'm all right. How was your weekend? How's everything in Annapolis?
It was great. I got back from a reunion with a bunch of guys from college, about 30 guys that I hung around with, and it was our 55th get-together. It was a great time.
And where was that? That's in New York?
We had it up in the Catskill Mountains. I went to school at RPI in Troy, New York.
Well, RPI, that's for smart people, right? Or at least...
Well, we weren't very smart when we were in college. I think we got smart later on.
Well, I mean, it is now. It might not have been then, but it is now, like a school for smart people. All right, I wanted to have you on, and I'm doing a segment that spawned by my experience last week, and something I find frustrating. So, you and I are going to do this for about 15 minutes now. How do you explain the fact that, you know, many units have more people take their own lives after they come home from a conflict than they have had killed in the conflict? How do you account for that? Why does that happen?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. A couple of thoughts that I have is, and when I got back from Vietnam in 67, I spent the next 50 years wondering about what I'd been through, what I'd done, and probably having, to some extent, post-traumatic stress disorder, but not admitting it. And part of it was you have survivor's guilt, and you are always thinking what I could have done, what I would have done, what I should have done. And I suspect a lot of the suicide for men and women when they return from combat tours nowadays is a lot of that. You've been out there, you've seen some pretty ugly stuff, you've been in the middle of it, but you come back and you will always wonder for the rest of your life, could you have done something different? Could you have done something better? Should you have done something different? And I think that has a much bigger impact than people realize, which makes post-traumatic winning so damn important. And I see it in particular with Vietnam vets when they get to retirement age and all of a sudden they go from working and keeping their mind busy with other things. They've got time on their hands, and believe it or not, 50 years later, they start going through that same thing. God, I should have done this. I could have done this. What would have happened if I'd done something different? And believe it or not, you see that damn post-traumatic problems creeping up on them when they're, you know, 60, 65 years old. And I think that's part of the reason, and very few people talk about it with vets at retirement age.
Well, most of your group didn't deal with it until a lot of the, I won't say most. I can't quantify it, but I've told this story before, but I remember seeing a therapist in West Los Angeles, and there was a group of Vietnam veterans that met before I would be, my appointment was at one every week or every other week, whenever the hell I went. And, he would see this group. And so they would be outside when I drove up. So I'd get out of my truck, right? And I they're all veterans, right? I'd say, hey, what's going on, guys? And I'd shoot the shit with them. And, then I'd go inside. And one day I said, hey, what do you talk about with those guys 50 years after the war? And he said to me, the same thing I talked to you about. And I said, what? And he said, Mac, they've never dealt with it. And now they're retired. And it's seeping out of the closet, right? It's coming out of the boxes that they've tried to stuff it in. So, I mean, I think that's surprising. I said, they tried to stuff Vietnam in the box? He said, yep.
You're 100% right, Mac. I think I've told you, and I can only relate to my experience. But I got back in 67, and other than the woman I met who became my wife, I literally talked to nobody about Vietnam till the mid-80s when they started building the Vietnam Memorial. And when they started building the Vietnam Memorial was when a few people started publishing books and paperbacks on Vietnam experiences and novels that anybody began to talk about it. It wasn't until the mid-80s I could even put Vietnam or the Marine Corps on a resume when we were going after projects and jobs. And I found, I've had a couple of get-togethers with people that were in the military during the Vietnam era in this community I live in. One couple was there talking this past year, and it turned out the wife had never heard her husband talk in 50-plus years about Vietnam. So the Vietnamists just locked it up in a goddamn box and stowed it away, and they literally, for ages, had nobody to talk to about it. And it wasn't until the mid-80s that things began to open up.
So we both know it doesn't go away, okay? So,
yeah.
All right, so, man, anybody who listens to the show knows that. Now, we talk about we're part of the less than 1% that serves, okay? So
yep.
That's supposed to be a relatively formidable group, okay? So I want to ask you to address that. And then I'll tell you the other half of me that has experienced trauma, that doesn't have anything to do with combat. There's people all over this country that deal with, that deal with murder, rape, domestic violence.
Murder, yep.
Right?
Yep.
But I don't know if it's not as visible. Suicide in among them is not as visible as it seems to be with veterans. So address those two issues, if you will. This 1% is supposed to be a pretty formidable segment of our population. And yet we lose more guys and girls at home than we do in combat. I mean, that's fucking crazy. And then we have other people. I mean, in my family's part of that group that deal with terrible tragedy, but it doesn't seem like the families then turn around and commit suicide because of it. I may not have that quantified very well in my head. I know I don't. But it just seems to me, when you look at the two narratives, there's something wrong there, Bob.
Well, there's a perplexing question, because this one half of 1% that goes in the military, in my mind, I think most everybody's mind, are probably the strongest and fittest and smartest of the youthful generation that's out there. So these should be the cream of the crop. And yet, that's where we get a large percentage of suicides and problems. One of the things I found out from my Vietnam experience, when you started to try and talk about it, it seemed like 4 out of 5 of the people you talked to, you'd say, yeah, I was in Vietnam, I was in the Marine Corps, 66, 67, and they'd immediately come out with a 5-minute dissertation of why they didn't go, or why they got turned down, or why the draft number was high, or whatever. And you get so tired of listening to that bullshit, you don't want to go any further with the conversation. But you need to pay attention to how you deal with veterans when they return. The amount of effort you put into getting an infantry battalion or a reinforced regiment ready to go into combat, you need to spend just as much time getting them prepared to come home and all of a sudden being released out into society.
So do we do that? And would you contend that reason that
we haven't done a worth a damn? We're getting better now slightly, but you haven't done hardly anything. And 50 years ago, you didn't do anything. You gave them a piece of paper and we got off the bus. But it's so important that you do that. And one of the things I've realized from dealing for so long at Walter Reed over the last 17, 18 years in Bethesda is a lot of the veterans that go into the military basically come from broken families. And they really had upsetting being raised as youths in really dysfunctional situations. And the Marine Corps, Navy, and Army, in effect, becomes their parent for 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, or whatever. And all of a sudden, when it's time to get out of the military, particularly after you've been in combat, they are scared to death about going back to the civilian world, because the only civilian world they know is the dysfunctional family that they grew up in going into the service. and the military has provided the only stability for them. So yep. They're scared to death about the civilian.
Yeah, but the same DNA that sends you through door number four and allows you to get through all the rest of that shit will certainly see you through that. And this whole victim, this veteran victim shit is exactly that shit. If you could do that, you can go find a job, trust me.
Mac, you know that because you've done it. And you've been in and out of the service. But for somebody that goes from being 17 or 18... and all of a sudden, the service is guiding every step of their way for 4, 5, 6, 8 years, and then bingo, you're back out on the street corner going down to the supermarket.
Well, but here's why I disagree. It didn't guide you when you chose that service. It told you, we don't really need you, and we might not accept you. You've got to get through our recruit training, and you had to get through that. They didn't get you
right
through that. They were trying to wash you out. So to me, the confidence you say, you know, I could do that. If you could do that, are you shitting me? You can't go find a fucking job? And that's why, to me, it's like, it's all of a sudden, veterans become this fucking burden to society because they're part of this 1%, and then all of a sudden, something happens, and they're all pieces, I won't say they're all, but you have a fair number that they can't navigate life. I mean, fuck.
The military needs to do a better job of educating these vets what they're getting back into. It's not that hard. Mac,
okay.
You've done it. It's not that hard.
I don't want to stray to that. So give me your short answer before I let you go, because our time is up now. You're one of four people I'll talk to about this in this hour. So the reason that the number of suicides is higher at home then the number of KIAs in combat is?
First of all, at combat, we're pretty good.
Right.
And we generally kick ass.
Right.
And secondly, people begin to think, I would have, could have, should have done more, and they think about that, and it eats at them.
So, guilt, and then the other thing you said was lack of training.
Yep. And what you need to do is follow the post-traumatic winning guidelines, and you'll get your ass back on track.
You know what? That's what I'm coming to, because this rock got my shoe last week, and I need to go see the Secretary of Defense, because I've got a proposition for him. So anyway, all right, sir. I appreciate your time on short notice this morning.
Great, Mac. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, joining us now from Texas is Tim Lynch. Tim, what's going on?
Not much, brother. Glad to join you.
All right. The question to you is, many units, and I just spent time with one in Waco, Texas, here a couple months ago, have experienced more death due to suicide when they come home than they did KIA in combat. Do you have, in your mind, a reason why that happens?
I do. And I want to make a distinction between suicides that happen on active duty, because my experience with that, which granted was in the 90s, two cases. One was a guy who had horrible background issues that we're not aware of. The other one was accidental, a strangulation, autoerotic thing. What I've been able to read and glean as I've read about this problem as it's cropped up, I think one of the biggest problems that these returning veterans have is a lack of connection and a lack of ability to visualize a future that matters to them. And in one sense, we've done this to them because we put so much responsibility on top of the shoulders of young men and women. I mean, a load of responsibility. I remember going out and seeing those combat outposts that you guys had all over southern Afghanistan. Lance Corporals, I mean, a 20-year-old kid in charge of this outpost, there's five other Marines, and everything that happens to them is his responsibility. When he comes home, he'll never face a situation where the stakes are that high, the responsibility is that grave, and the trust that was given him that implicit. And I think that's the hard part. And the other thing is, with the 1% phenomenon, we can't come home and repair to a VFW, and even if we're sitting by ourselves drinking and scowling, we're at least talking to guys that know what the hell we're about. We've got at least some connection to somebody that knows something about what we've been through. And now in America, I have a Marine Corps League detachment down here that's growing by leaps and bounds. There's one guy that was in Iraq. And that's it. Everything else is older guys who are wanting to get back in touch with their roots, you know. And so how do you address these guys that are, you know, the Marine Corps doesn't need them. A lot of them want to stay, but they can't. You know, there's only so many staff sergeants that can, billets. So you're forcing out people that have had a unique experience in which they had a connection that was larger than life, that was more meaningful than their own family connections in some respects. And they had responsibilities placed on top of them, and they knew exactly who they were and what they were expected to do, and they were appreciated. And you're not going to find that working at Home Depot.
So the reason we have more suicide in among units that fought is that they don't experience the same connection when they come home as they felt when they were forward?
I very strongly believe that most addictions and these problems are a lack of connection and meaning in the individual's life. Because when you start hitting a downward spiral, which I think stereotypically happens in a divorce court where you get your ass hammered because you're a veteran and therefore a suspect in the family court's mind as to your mental stability and propensity for violence. And I've dealt with exactly that. It starts there, and then all you need is a couple slips. And you're done. I mean, look at us. I live in Texas. My kids are in Australia.
Okay,
my father's
hold on. Let's go back to the 1% though. But you're part of 1% that serves. You're not, right? You're not a little pumpkin.
You're not. But what is the culture telling you? What is everything you read about returning vets? What is everything in the media talking about? Oh, we got to get help because they're damaged, because they went and they did all this shit. Hey, look, brother. I don't buy that, you know. And the guys that stay in the Marine Corps don't have to deal with this because they're surrounded by a system that supports them. They don't ever have to go through that. I don't think my father had to suffer as a Vietnam veteran like his peers did that got out of the Marine Corps, right? We're a people now that are spread out all over the country. We very rarely go back to our same hometowns, and I think that lack of connection is the underlying factor to this increase. Because I mean, if it was still like it was when we were growing up, where suicide was an absolute sin and we were convinced they were going to hell, I don't think you'd see as much of it. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. But the social message seems to reinforce that they've been victims, and there's financial compensation for going to the VA and getting this all sorted out, and et cetera, you know.
And all that stuff's available, and it's designed to soften the landing, right? I mean,
that's what it's supposed to do. I don't think it is.
So there's so many more tools, yet we still have. And again, you know that when I say that many units, right, have lost more here in the United States post-conflict than they did fighting with the enemy in
clusters, right? Mostly in clusters. One guy goes and then three guys go.
Well, you believe the suicide thing?
Yeah. It seems to me that's a phenomenon. And it's not 100% obvious.
No, but it seems very common. Certain units are touched by it. And as you said, when you get one, there seems to be that touches off others. So what you would say is this dislocation that we experience as we leave, sends us adrift, and the people that can't reconnect are adrift.
I would say that the only thing I can think of that could prepare you for this is post-traumatic winning. In other words, knowing at the very front end that you are going to be changed when you come out, and you're going to have issues, as anybody else is going to have issues. I mean, it doesn't have to be a Marine necessarily, but we're talking Marines, and this is somewhere where we have a certain amount of control, right? And I think we should upload up front because, you know, you stay in Marine Corps and you're a sergeant and you're a squad leader and a good squad leader in a good battalion, you're somebody. I mean, you're somebody everybody knows and people want to admire and whatnot. Your word means something. And that's not, you're not going to find that in the civilian context ever again. I mean, you'll be lucky to get the same level of responsibility if you work 20 years. And I think that's a problem. But the only answer is knowing that that's going to be a problem and making an effort to stay connected. I made no effort to stay connected when I retired, and I suffered for it.
No, I'm coming to the same conclusion. You know what? So the dislocation and the lack of training.
I think it's a lack of awareness, right?
When I say training specifically, I mean something like post-traumatic winning that says, this is your future with certainty. These are the things you will encounter, and all are conquerable. Blah, 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 blah. And there's a ton of resources out there, but this is the road that you will go down, most of you, with certainty. So, just so you know, you're now notified, all right? So, just like other things, you got notified that recruit training would be a certain way. You've overcome that. The DNA that brought you through door number 4 has seen you through. That same DNA will get you a job, and we'll see you through this. I tell you that with certainty.
I absolutely believe that, because you can look when we let go of a kid who's at the 6, 7, 8 year mark, you know, who's been a good solid performer, he'll never again reach the level of responsibility in all probability that he had as a Marine Corps. But we're humans; we can react to that in two different ways. That's either good news or it's bad news. And if you set it up as something that you know is coming, you can make that into good news, because it's not like those traits and attributes that you learned when you were leading men in combat or weren't leading men in combat, leading men in training. It doesn't matter. It's the same damn thing, the level of responsibility.
Right.
Those things you learned are valuable lessons that you'll use later in life. And it's all how you look at this damn thing. And right now we're looking at this as a crisis, and the veterans are victims because they're not getting enough money, or they got screwed over here, or they got darned, you know, damaged in fire pits, and I resent that. You resent that, and it's not reality. But the reality is we do have a problem, and there's got to be ways of educating Marines before they reach this state that look, this isn't the end of the world. Remember that kid you had on that was all upset about the babies, the children Nimrod's in
Staff Sergeant Parker.
Right. And that is the most common phobia amongst trauma merchants who deal with children, pediatric trauma there is. He's thinking he's a freak because he feels this way about kids, not knowing that what he's reacting to is the most common human reaction to the sights that he saw that day when he went down into Nimrod's province.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about. You got to know this stuff.
This is
a mystery.
Then he has another Marine in Okinawa after he comes off that deployment telling him, hey, you didn't see shit. There's no fighting going on over there. So, don't even tell me about your bullshit stories. Right.
Oh, dude, I ran when I was an EMT in Bethesda. I ran a call with 6 or 7 children head on. Oh, Jesus, I have nightmares about that. You don't want to deal with kids.
Right.
That's horrible.
And then you have somebody telling you, but you don't rate. Right. So
yeah.
So shut up about that.
Like, no. So there's an education thing. You know, we have this mind. We have this picture that is by common culture put in our mind. Of the hard guy who's been laid low with some bad news, and what's he do? He goes in and starts drinking whiskey out of a shot glass and brooding and whatnot. And this is what people think is an appropriate response. When in truth is, dude, the last thing you want to be near is liquor. I mean, again, for Christ's sake, that's a social lubricant for social situations.
But that was look, going to mental health was not acceptable. Being a drunk was in our culture, in the culture that Tim and I grew up in, the Marine Corps as young officers. I mean, that's a straight up fact that being a drunk was okay, right? Being blotto passed out drunk on the shitter in your dress blues, crashed against the wall, somebody else, you know, dragging you and putting you to sleep after they pulled up your pants. That was okay, right? We'll get through that. But saying I need to go to mental health was not.
Exactly, and some of that. I mean, our culture was heavy in the drinking for a long time, and of course the Hollywood and whatnot reflected that. But those days are long gone now,
right.
You know. And there's other. It seems to me that that you've got to cut things down to the quick, that you've got to have an explanation that makes sense to people that they could use to integrate into their behavior as they go on. And I think my explanation is that loss of connection, that loss of an ability to envision a future that has the same meaning that being a stinking corporal in the United States Marine Corps had, that knowing that, being forearmed about that, allows you to adapt faster, because you're going to have to suck it up. At some point, you're no longer a Superman. The Superman suit's gone, and you're just an average friggin' American. Like it or not, that's just the way it is.
All right, so as I go down this, so the lack of a connection, the lack of familiarity with the path that you'll travel, so education, and then there's one other... So lack of connection, lack
of envisioning a meaningful future.
So a letdown.
Yeah.
So a letdown. But that doesn't have to be the case, because to me, if you complete the sentence, look, you're part of 1% that does this. You can replicate this. You know that, right? And there's a way that you do it, right? There's a way you do it. Right, you got to do these things. You got to go. We have the resources. You got to go create your resume. You got to go network. There's all these different platforms to help you. There's people that'll hire you, right? But it's not going to come knocking on your door begging you to come through. That's not the way it works. And so, to me, that letdown is my opinion. That's self-inflicted, man. That's self-inflicted, because there's a lot of people that want to help. There's a lot of resources out there to help you. And so, and much more than any other segment of society, and yet you can't get there? Come on, man.
Look, I had a...
It's what you're talking about exists. I'm thinking out loud from the one...
No.
How do you go from being part of 1% to being... You can't get a job, to being a victim. Come on.
I had a conversation with a Marine recently got out who got shot up pretty bad. He had spent a couple of years in the Wounded Warrior Battalion, and he was a bitter guy and whatnot. And my conversation with him was a fucking ass chewing. And I'm like, are you fucking insane? I mean, do you realize what they've done for you? You know, basically, using that tough love approach that I think that I'm modeling your concepts. But I told him, you're looking at this in entirely wrong. Yeah, you got screwed. Everybody gets screwed. What the hell are you worried about you for? You've got a lot of things going for you that this country's done for you that they didn't do for contractors, and many more of them got shot up than you guys did. They don't do for Afghan soldiers. I mean, good God, man. Or you're bitching because they paid you for 30 months, a full pay and benefits and vacation money? Are you shitting me? And you're bitching about that? Oh, they should have treated me better. Oh, no, bud. And so I often think the other thing is that oftentimes when you find veterans that are very, very deeply in the clutches of self-pity, they need a kick in the ass. Not somebody to tell them it's okay to be full of self-pity. Self-pity is that's where the devil dwells, bro. You can't be doing that.
Right. All right, and lack of a connection, the letdown, and a lack of education.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you for doing this on short notice.
Yes, sir. Right. Glad to contribute.
All right. Thanks, Tim. That is Tim Lynch. O-Doc Lynch, as you know him. Interesting. Interesting. The one and only, Alex Hollings. We'll see if we'll get him through the wonders of Skype. I'm like, hey, when I say 940, hey, I fucking mean 940, bro.
Hey, that's why I'm here.
All right, here's the question. Many units lose more, and I'll just talk about Marines, to suicide than they did killed in action.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an explanation for that?
That's a complicated question. I have what I would call an explanation.
Okay.
In my opinion, I think one of the biggest problems is that when you're in combat, especially, but when you're in the military in general, you tend to have at least one objective. Often you have many objectives. You've got like 5-meter targets, 15-meter, 50-meter, 500-meter targets. that you're engaged with, right? You've got goals, you've got things that you need to accomplish, you have people holding you accountable for your behavior. And when you get out of the military, you're met with kind of like a compounding series of issues, the first of which being that you have an absence of those objectives, right? You no longer have these objectives keeping you task-oriented. And then couple that with what I call checklist syndrome, which is something that I think a lot of Marines in particular deal with, which is kind of like we always have a checklist to go off of. There's always a sheet of paper with a bunch of boxes that we need to fill out that tells us what to do next, and we don't have that when we get out, which we feel liberated by. But it takes away another kind of layer of that organization in our head. So now we don't have objectives anymore. We don't have a checklist to fill out. And on top of all that, you lose your sense of identity in a very real way when you separate from the Marine Corps, especially, I would argue. When you're an active duty Marine, I mean, I don't care if you're a box kicker, a cook, or MARSOC, you're a Marine. You know, when you go to Applebee's and people ask you what you do, you say, I'm a Marine. And often you say it with a lot of pride, right? So then when you get out and people ask you what you do, you go, oh, well, I was a Marine and now I'm going to school, I guess. Or I was a Marine, but now, you know, I'm working for UPS and I'm doing pretty well. But it doesn't have that same, you know, sense of identity that you used to have. So you take this lack of objectives and you take that lack of checklist and you take that loss of identity and you start to make allowances for yourself. This is something that a lot of people talk about with serial killers. Is the road to being a serial killer is full of small allowances. I think the road to suicide is as well. And what I mean by that is you're having a hard day. You know, you don't feel good about yourself. You don't feel good in general. So what do? You go, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to take a mental health day. I'm going to spend most of the day on the couch. I'm going to eat crappy food. I'm going to watch crappy movies. I'm going to sit here and watch, you know, a marathon of MASH. And, you know, eat a box of Pop-Tarts, and I'll feel better about myself, and tomorrow I'll readdress. Then tomorrow comes, and you don't feel good either. So you make some more allowances. You establish a new normal that's full of bad habits. And once that's normal, then you seek new bad habits. Then it doesn't seem like that big a deal. I'll smoke a bowl. Or I'll stop working out this week. You know, I'll get back to it next week. And then you don't next week either. And before you know it, you've turned into this guy that isn't the guy you think of yourself as. That he's the guy you were afraid you were going to end up being. And now you feel too far gone to get back to being who you used to be. I think that it's a process. I don't think that a lot of guys, certainly for some guys, you know, they get out and they face suicidal ideations right away. But I think for a lot of guys, it's a compounding loss of who you feel like you were. And you're replacing it with this new guy that you don't like that much. That's my theory.
All right, so let me start from the top. So a loss of purpose, a loss of the infrastructure that has supported you, a loss of the way we work, which is, you know, the tasks are quantified in checklists, and there is a structure to our lives, and we know how to achieve things. And then we lose our identity, that word, whether it's I'm a soldier, I'm a Ranger, I'm a Marine.
I think is a really big part of it. It is for me, at least. It was probably the hardest part of being, I was medically separated, but I knew it was coming, you know, but the hardest part for me was coming up with something new to call myself, you know, and,
Alex,
and I think a lot of people
Alex,
deal with that.
Alex wasn't good enough?
You know, I didn't feel like it was.
Well, and I say that because, right? You're part of the 1%, man. If you're a Marine, you're part of the 0.7% of 1% of 1%. That's fucking zero. You're part of 0% of the population that does what you do. And so, I mean, endemic to that is what you are, what you've accomplished in your life. And yet,
you're totally right. You're totally right. And that is what you should think.
And
you
see,
know?
To me, that DNA that's because all that structure you got after you fought the fight to get in the Marine Corps, after you fought the fight to become a Marine and not get washed out of recruit training, you did that. Nobody else did that for you. You know, that I think, I mean, there is truth in maybe you could be one of us, but we're not going to give it to you. You're going to earn that shit. And you do, yet, and we're proud of being part of that less than 1%, and then it goes away.
You know, and I think that's why you see a lot of veterans becoming affiliated with veteran organizations, you know, because it gives you a chance to kind of re-engage with that identity. You know what I mean? I don't have to be Sergeant Hollings to still be the guy that accumulated all those experiences, that learned all those lessons. You know what I mean? I can still be that guy without wearing a uniform every day. But I think that this is a struggle that a lot of people face, you know? I think that when you get out, you always have a bit of a crisis of faith, right? And during that crisis, you can make decisions. You know, I've talked about it before where, you know, I had a lot of surgeries on my way out, and the VA just kind of gave me like as many opioids as I wanted, you know what I mean? Right. At one point, I went to one doctor for my ankle because I had a surgery recently. He gave me a bottle of 60 Percocets. Later on that same week, I went to another doctor for my knee, which I was about to have surgery on, and he gave me a bottle of 40 Percocets, and I didn't think anything of it. I just brought it home, and I stockpiled because I was like, oh, I'm sure I'll need them later, because I tended not to take them at first. And then as you go, you start taking them because things hurt, and then you start taking them to make sure things don't hurt. Right. And before you know it, you run the risk of just taking them to take them. You know, I had the benefit of being a part of a family, my wife in particular, who was like, hey, you know, they're giving you a lot of these pills. I think that's kind of dangerous. I really think that we should be mindful of that. And wow. I hadn't really thought about it. It had never occurred to me that I could end up addicted to these pills. Imagine what would have happened to me if I didn't have a wife that was like, hey, you know, this is kind of weird that they keep giving you all these painkillers. You know, I think that it's really easy to feel bad and just want to feel a little bit better today. And when you add a lot of those days up, you turn into a guy you never meant to be, you know?
So the loss of purpose, the loss of structure, and I'll include checklists in that, and the loss of your identity.
Yeah, I suppose the checklist is kind of a loss of accountability. You know, you're not accountable to anyone anymore. And as much as Marines are self-motivated, as much as Marines are problem solvers, we also like to bitch, you know? It's really uncommon for you to walk into a squad bay and be like, hey, I need 4 volunteers for a working party. It's weird to see guys really eager to jump on that working party, right? But living that life is good for you. Living that life of being accountable for your work and for your actions and for more than yourself is good for you in a lot of ways. And when you lose that, you have to teach yourself to be accountable to yourself. And that's tough, you know?
But it seems to me this, the strength of the DNA that brings you through door number 4 defeats the victim, the veteran victim narrative.
It should.
And can get you a job, can see you through most things.
And honestly, self-pity is a big part of this, man. So people need to, in our current society.
Does the sympathy generated for veterans and what you've quote unquote been through, whether you've been through it or not, does that open a door for some veterans?
I think for some it certainly does. You know, we live in a society now that really prizes the victim. You know, being a victim in some ways in our society is one of the most powerful positions you can be in now socially. You know, if you're a victim of something, you can take to social media and you'll receive a great deal of support. You become a hero in the eyes of the masses because the person who victimized you, the bad guy, is who we all want to feel this righteous indignation, this righteous outrage.
Right.
Being a victim is a powerful position. And so for a lot of veterans, especially if you're a veteran who's struggling with this lack of identity, a victim is an identity that you can welcome. And I think that we see this, and I don't mean to make it political, because everybody's dealing with their things in different ways. And your politics are your own. They can be whatever you'd like. I think, but a lot of times when you see veterans that are outspoken against the military, veterans who are outspoken against defense initiatives or are really opposed to guns and things like this, what we're doing is we're framing them as victims. And look how powerful this victim narrative is, you know? I'm not saying that that's the only way that you're opposed to the military-industrial complex or guns or 2A or whatever, but I think we see it a lot. I think we see a lot of veterans present themselves as damaged goods. You know, Mattis has talked about this before, is that we need to get away from the idea of the damaged veteran narrative because he doesn't believe in it, neither do I. But people are people, right? Veterans are people just like everybody else. And I think for some people who are lacking that sense of identity, lacking a feeling of belonging, they're embraced as soon as they decide to become a victim, which is good if you feel victimized, if you have been victimized. It's good that you'll be embraced and supported. But in our society, we tend to prize victimhood.
But if it's, but if you haven't been victimized, it's just a soft place?
I mean,
an easy place to go?
To be fair, this is a subjective thing. So let's say you haven't been victimized in my eyes or your eyes, but you feel as though you have been. That's certainly something that you should address and deal with. You know, counseling is an excellent opportunity. It's an excellent outlet for you to go talk to someone about how you feel as though you've been victimized. But leaning into the problem with being the problem with embracing that victimhood is using it as justification for your actions, right? Once you start to justify bad behavior, once you start to justify self-destructive behavior because you're a victim, that's when it's a bad thing. You can feel victimized and use that to light a fire under your ass. You can feel like a victim and go, I never will be again. Or you can feel like a victim and go, well, it's not my fault. It's the Marine Corps' fault. It's not my fault. It's Iraq's fault. It's not my fault. It's the VA's fault. And as soon as you get away from, and as awful as this sounds, nobody in the world really gives a shit about you but you. You know, your family circle is gonna be there for you. Your friends are going to be there for you, but at the end of the day, you have to be responsible for yourself in a very real way because they're stuck taking care of themselves as well. That's a full-time job. Sure. They can help, but the onus is on you to get better. And but once you start telling yourself that you're a victim, then there's not that much incentive to get better for some people, I think.
I just when you read it about, yeah, our company fought in Ramadi in 2005. You know, we had 9 guys, KIA. We've had 16. You know, we've lost 16 from suicide. And you're just like, shit. How can that be that we lose more to suicide than we do in combat? Like, what aren't we doing? You know, what aren't we doing? What aren't we preparing people for? How can that be in a day and age when we can communicate so easily with each other that we lose so many? And it just
it's heart wrenching, man.
Oh man, it just and again, this is the less than one. This is the less than 1%, right? These people are uniquely qualified to go forward and face the rigors of combat for the United States of America, right? And then they come home and somehow or other, they get lost, whatever happens. And so I just wondered this morning what your theory was about how they get lost. Because
I do think there's one thing worth noting here, too, is that suicide rates across most demographics have been on the increase in recent years. Right. The military is by and large the leader in this field. You're much more likely to commit suicide if you've served in the military than otherwise. But suicide is an upward moving trend across most demos in the United States. So there's got to be something that we're doing culturally wrong that's making this seem like such a feasible solution to a problem, you know? And I don't know what that is. There's obviously some common thread, right? Because we're seeing it increase across most demographics. So it's not just about being in the military. I think being in the military exacerbates it. But there's certainly something else at play here about our society at large, I think.
Well, no, I mean, I've talked to my friends as a kid. I mean, if you committed suicide, I mean, you know, you were going to go to hell. So nobody did, you know, we didn't do that. I mean, we grew up I grew up in a culture that went to church more, you know, much more readily than people go to church today. And, you know, and we got raised by people that said, no, you know, look, you can't do that. And so it wasn't an issue, and it was an anomaly when it happened, you know. And so.
Whereas now, like, it's sometimes it feels like hardly a week goes by where I don't get a Facebook notification telling me about the birthday of one of my friends that has killed themselves, right. You know? Right. Unfortunately, I know a number of Marines who have committed suicide. I think the total count of Marines that I served alongside now is at 4, but I think Marines that I know personally, at least, you know, met once or twice, I think I'm up at like 6 or 7 at this point, which is insane. That's crazy. You know, I only worked in 2 duty stations.
Right.
You know, granted, I worked in a number of units within, like, for TADs, FAFs, and things like that.
Right.
I trained a lot of reserve guys and did some traveling there, but still, in my tiny little Marine Corps tenure, you know, less than 8 years, that means that I know, by average, I know at least one person that's killed themselves per year of service that I was in the Marine Corps. That's crazy.
Right.
Absolutely crazy.
No. Okay, so, just to review, the loss of purpose, the loss of the structure, the loss of accountability, which, you know, you talk about checklists and translates to accountability.
I think so.
The loss of identity, and then a culture that opens up the door to victimhood very easily and certainly embraces veterans who believe they've been victimized in a very, very warm way. So, I mean, that can be seductive.
And I want to be clear again that there are a lot of veterans that have been victimized. You know what I mean? There are women who were sexually assaulted.
Right, right.
There are men who've been sexually assaulted. There are people who, not through any fault necessarily of the U.S. military, but experienced terrible, terrible things while they were in service. And they have every right to feel victimized, and they have every right to pursue help. The thing is that you've got to pursue help. The goal has to be to get better. The goal can't be to make sure as many people know how hurt I am, as hurt as I want to make sure everybody knows that I'm hurt. It's okay if you want to share your story. And for some people, that's probably good and cathartic.
Right.
But the goal has got to be to get better. We need to get away from this romanticized vision of the salty veteran who's living, you know, in the shadow of his service, who's struggling every day. You know, that movie, Thank You for Your Service, with Miles Teller and I forgot who else was in it. Came out a few years ago. I mean, in my opinion, that represented everything that was wrong with the veteran experience. It was a whole movie about how veterans come home, and if you burn dinner, they're going to think that they're back in Ramadi, and they're going to start kicking the door down to beat up their pregnant wife. Or every veteran is, you know, got a mouthful of shotgun in the laundry room crying, just hoping that his wife doesn't hear. That's not the truth of the veteran experience, but we are creating a culture where it seems like you're not a real vet. You didn't see real shit. The war wasn't real for you unless you're struggling now. Unless you're, you know, teeth, you know, gritted, tears in your eyes, lying to your wife about how suicidal you are. That's the only way to be a real tough veteran now. That's the only way to prove that you saw some shit. And that's not real. That's not the truth, you know? You can be really screwed up and saw nothing. You know, there could have been indirect fire, artillery fire coming in to the base that you never left the wire, and that was enough to really, really hurt you, and that's okay. You could also be a MARSOC guy who's got, you know, who's killed more people with your hands than most people have ever even seen in combat, and be okay. And that doesn't mean that you're wrong either.
Right. Do we come anywhere near educating about this as we leave, and to emphasize the point that, hey, that DNA that brought you to us will see you through the rest of us?
We do a terrible job, in my opinion. I think the Marine Corps is exceptionally good at training you to be a warfighter. I think the Marine Corps is terrible at training you to do just about anything else. Whether we're talking suicide prevention, whether we're talking you know, EEO requirements, anything that comes with a PowerPoint has been watered down to the point of no longer being effective,
right,
in my opinion.
Yeah,
our suicide prevention training, more often than not, just trains those with suicidal ideations how to not get noticed, how to make sure that you don't advertise your intentions to the command. You know, I think we do a terrible job of the training and education standpoint.
Interesting. All right. That's all I needed from you. Thank you, sir.
Well, I want to say one more thing before I go, and I bet you if you're asking other people, they're all going to say the same. But your post-traumatic winning program, this isn't bullshit. You didn't pay anybody to come on and say post-traumatic winning is a good thing. It's a good thing. What you're doing is a good thing. I'm hearing it from Marines that are on active duty, that are at the presentations you're giving. So I think the secret to this, the answer is not the Marine Corps putting together another PowerPoint. The answer to this is guys like you who understand and are engaging with the problem and engaging with Marines, you know? So I just want to say what you're doing is kick-ass, and I really respect it.
Why are you spying on me, dog?
What do you mean, why am I spying on you?
Why are you spying on me, dog? No, you know, that's what brings this. That's where this rock in this shoe comes from, right? So the same DNA that brings you to us, this is the DNA that will see you through this, that will see you through getting a job. That makes you unique on this planet,
and that's what we've got to start. The problem is it's really hard to feel like
right. We don't tell them that though. You're not a fucking victim. You're a fucking Marine, and you will be that till the day you die. And so get after it, man. You have more tools available to you to get a job, and there's people out there that are looking for you. All right, get after it. Trust me, you'll do fine. Put your nose down and get after it. But it's like I look around, like, are we doing it? Are we equipping them, right? Because it is true. If you've ever seen
them, simplest thing, like SEPs and TAPS, is a really poorly managed class, in my opinion. Maybe it's gotten better since I left the Marine Corps, but it starts with things like
my son had a good experience, Patrick. My son,
that's great.
Right, and again, he's a lieutenant. I know, maybe that's different, but I don't think it is, right? Patrick worked hard to separate. And he got a job with KPMG as a consultant, right? That I don't even know that he should have got, but he did. I don't know how the fuck he did it, but he did. And I do know how he got it. He worked hard, and he networked hard, and he interviewed hard, and he refined his resume hard. He worked at it. The same.
He's a damn smart guy. I've spoke to Patrick a couple of times.
I don't know about that. But the same persistence and shit that made him a good Marine. Got him, right? It's the same thing.
I cannot tell you how many times I have said that to my buddies who are thinking about getting out. You know, because I got out and I followed a very strange career progression, right? I landed a good job as a military contractor, not doing kick-ass stuff, but doing paperwork. And then from there, I pursued this crazy career of journalism that by happenstance worked out, and I'm doing well. But it makes it seem like, oh my God, what the hell is the outside world like? You know, and I tell people all the time, if you were good at being a Marine, you're going to be good at being whatever you want to be. You didn't know how to be a Marine when you got there. I mean,
your journalism career just worked out as bullshit because you grabbed that thing by the throat on more than one occasion, took more than four jobs on one occasion, and made it work. And that's you, right?
And that's true. You know, Thank you. I would argue I'm just as lucky as I am a hard worker. I try my best to be a hard worker.
Well, there's a saying that goes with that.
The harder you work, the better your luck is, right?
Right.
And I try to live by that. Well. But I think for a lot of Marines, I know for me it was definitely true. One of my biggest fears getting separated was, how the hell am I going to find a job? And one of the retention techniques in the Marine Corps is kind of convincing you that you're not going to find one. So I think we need to start right off the bat with, it's not just about suicide prevention training. I think it's about self-worth training. It's about teaching people how to get a job effectively. In my SEPs and TAPS class, we barely went over resumes. We talked about how if you use the wrong paper, if it's not weighted properly, you won't get a job. We talked about how if you salt your food before you taste it at a lunch interview, you won't get a job.
What?
I became a hiring manager later and confirmed all that stuff's bullshit.
Right.
If a hiring manager doesn't hire a good candidate because they salted their food before tasting it, it's a shitty hiring manager.
Right. You don't want to work for them anyway.
Because
they're an idiot.
Exactly. You know, like, you need to walk into a job interview the same way you walk into a meritorious board, which is, I may not know the answers, but I'm going to be confident in telling you when I don't. You know, I think what we need to do is we need to remind Marines that it's not the title Marine. It's not the uniform that makes you worthwhile. You're a Marine internally by the time you separate, you know?
You were a Marine. You know, let me tell you, this is what I firmly believe. What makes the Marine Corps different are the people that look at the challenge when we are not really sure what goes with it, and we look at the propaganda and the stuff that says, you know, we don't promise you shit, right? Maybe you could be one of us, the few, the proud Marine. And
that's how they got me.
Right, and looked at other things and said, yeah, I'll do that one. Like, well, wait a minute. Are you sure? I know I'm not sure I can do it, but I want to try. And
the Army recruiter offered me a bonus, and the Marine Corps recruiter told me he didn't need me. And guess which one I ended
right.
up going
but,
for.
But that's the DNA, right? That's the DNA that John Bazelon had. I mean, that's the thing that'll see you through. And so, all right, I'm done with you. Thank you.
Hey, no problem, brother. Anytime.
There you have it. Alex Hollings. He from theloadoutroom.com. And you can find his work all over the place, Alex Hollings. So, Alex, well done. And let me get Ken Rogers on the phone, and you're going to hear from Vietnam veteran. You're going to get his perspective on the same question. Well, because it landed in my bonnet last week, and it is irritating me. All right, it's irritating me. So I'm stalling right now in case you can't tell. I'm trying to find Ken Rogers' phone number. If you're tuning in expecting to hear General Mattis, that interview will run tomorrow. I had to. I did delay today to make sure that the server didn't get crashed because the people I spoke with says, hey, by the way, you know, he's a bit of a big deal globally. You know that, right? And I said, yeah, I do know that. And they said, okay, we'll make sure that you can handle the traffic. So anyway, Ken Rogers.
Sorry, the number you called was busy. Please try again later.
What?
Disculpe. El número que usted ha llamado está ocupado.
¿Cómo?
Por favor, intente de nuevo más tarde.
¿Qué?
Message 14.
Oh.
Switch. To.
Don't want to talk to that dude. I messaged Ken Rogers this morning. And, he actually made me laugh. Let me find it. And then we'll call him. Do you have 20 minutes at noon to come on and talk about it today? Yes. New your time or mine? Yours. Assuming you're in Idaho. Today I'm in Idaho. And then he gives me the phone number. And so then he says, I said, mystery topic. He says, no surprise there.
Sorry. The number you called was busy.
What?
Please try again later.
All right. I think I have his Skype shit. So let me interrupt his phone call and jack his Skype ass up. Let's see. Ooh, that's somebody complicated. Or maybe I don't. Oh, and here he is. Joining me now by the wonders of cell phones is Ken Rogers. Ken, good morning. How are you?
I'm alive, sir. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm all right. Welcome to All Marine Radio and the Mystery Hour.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, so I went down to MCRD last week, and I did post-traumatic winning down there. And pretty cool experience. Marines are great, sailors are great, and support people were great, right? The command was great, everybody great. And what's different, though, now is when I did it, right, January, February, March, it was a theoretical proposition. Now with the data that's come out of the 2nd Marine Division, and again, knock on wood, they've had one suicide in 7 months. Now there's a body of work that goes with it, and I can tell them that you can replicate that here, and here's what you got to do. And then I was reading something, and I saw something that I think we're both familiar with, that a lot of units lose more people to suicide after they come home than they did in combat. Do you have an explanation of that? I mean, that seems like the craziest thing in the world that we lose more guys after they come home than we did in the actual fight itself.
Well, you know, it's probably really a complicated issue, I think. But, you know, I think if guys come home and then they become estranged from the world that they're living in, it's, and I, you know, I contemplated a few times myself after I got back from Vietnam that it's like there's nobody that you can connect with who understands what you've experienced. And I think a lot of that, you know, is probably post-traumatic stress issue, but I also think it's this business they're talking about now called moral injury is a lot of it. You know, I went over here, was raised to do this, this is what we believe, this is what we believe as a society, and then we go off to combat and we don't, you know, our job is to kill people. And I, you know, that's easy enough for us to do when we're in the Corps and we're over there doing it because your life's on the line, but sometimes when you come back, I think you begin to ponder what is the meaning of my life in relationship to society in general versus what I was expected to do and what I did when I went to combat. I think that's part of it. So I think some people never can figure out how to reintegrate themselves into the life they lived before they became in the military. And on and on and on and on. You know, it depends on the individual, I suppose. You know, I was too damn scared to commit suicide. So, even though I thought about it, then the choice that I made at that moment was that I would rather face what I knew, than what I didn't. So I don't know if that's answering any of your questions or not.
Yeah, it's the why part of it, right? And I think that the things that you said, that you're now estranged from a culture that you come back to. And your attempts to reconnect with that culture, obviously don't connect you. And, you have a different perspective, obviously, and you're a storyteller as well. So I was curious to what your thoughts, and you're no stranger to this narrative. So I was just curious, and your Vietnam experience was was not an everyday experience. It was an acute experience, and you come home, and you're dealing with everything that people deal with. For Bravo Company, has suicide been an issue? Because if you say that suicide is, and I don't know that, and I'll just throw this out there, suicide might be more pronounced in units that, you know, that took more casualties, that did more fighting, that were forced to confront, you know, very difficult things. Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Marines at Khe Sanh would be the personification of that. And whether it was the experience of shelling on a daily basis, whether it was the ghost patrol, whether it was the payback, I mean, that was some serious shit you guys did. Did you guys have a substantial problem with suicide when guys came back?
Well, I know of two guys that did suicide. I knew one of them personally over there. He was in our platoon for a while before the siege started, and then he got moved over to another one that I believe was the platoon that was involved in the ghost patrol. I lost track after him after that, but he committed suicide relatively early versus guys that, you know, I know of one guy that was a corpsman who worked in that day, but dealt with putting people back together, and he committed suicide after, I believe, 40 years.
After 4-0?
Yeah, after 40 years, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I, you know, so, honestly, I mean, to me, the corpsman who work on their friends, I don't know how they're ever right in the head after that. And I to me, that's almost, I don't want to say understand, more, most understandable is that our corpsmen that deal with that. And so, wow. But that's a pretty small number given the acute nature of what you all experienced.
Well, that's all that I know about. I don't know about
right. Okay.
People that were out there that just dropped out. You know, I mean, if you didn't stay in contact with your comrades, you know, one guy that was actually in the same squad that I was in with, I think, committed suicide by just drug and alcohol abuse. I mean, he was bumming around, and certain times he'd show up in somebody's town, and they'd take care of him for a few days, and he'd disappear, and then finally one of the guys in Bravo Company got a call that somebody found him dead in the bathroom. In, I believe, in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and he'd been in there probably 2 weeks before anybody found him. I could see him committing suicide. Another guy committed suicide. He lost a jaw, his lower jaw, on the Ghost Patrol, and he committed suicide 20 years later. So, and there may have been other guys, but those are the only ones that I'm aware of.
Right.
And some, you know, the various times that they did it, you know, it's obvious that for some of them, they never just could reconcile being back in this society we live in where, you know, basically you can get anything you want and life is wonderful if you let it be. And what they had seen and what they had come to see as their own role in the insanity of it all.
Right. Interesting. My contention, though, now is, you know, that DNA that brought you into the Marine Corps, that DNA that got you through recruit training, that DNA that got you through all of that can get you through this if somebody will tell you the truth. And that's what I do now, right? I mean, I've taken the things that I've learned from guys like you and other people I've been fortunate to cross paths with. And I put it together, and that's what I do. Is that's post-traumatic winning. That's that roadshow, and say this is the path that you'll go down, and you can do it. You can do it. And the key thing, and honestly, I mean, you have something in common with Eugene Sledge, right? You know that.
Right. Sure. I told a story. Okay. So, and I told it as honestly as I could. You know, no bullshit. You know, this is what it's like to go, and I still do that. You know, I was just back in Washington, D.C., presenting to a group of vet corps officials, I just told them what it was like, and what it was like to come home, and I was, you know, pretty in your face with the story of this, and, you know, if you tell the people the truth and you don't whitewash it,
right.
And make it some kind of glorious thing that it wasn't. Well, you know, for a lot of guys, this isn't glorious. I mean, goddamn, you're scared to death, and people are dying, and people that you learn to love and depend on are dying, and it's just that's not glory. I don't give a shit what anybody says. So
yeah, you know, even when you come home and you're standing in formation and people are being awarded medals and which is quote unquote the glorious part, it still isn't glorious, because when somebody reads a citation of what happened that day, most of what happened wasn't glorious.
Right. It was frightening and vicious and savage and
right.
and you did it because you had to, basically.
And that day in that award citation recalls, right, the four or five guys that you lost that day.
Right.
And so
right.
You know, and most of the time, I mean, just was awarded the Medal of Honor here last year. Dakota Myers, I want to say in the last 90 days, did an article with, it might have been Marine Corps Times, talking about how he hates his Medal of Honor. And he said,
interesting.
Right? I mean, it was a horrible day. To, you know, I mean, your quote, there's nothing glorious about this medal. there's nothing good about the memories I have of this day. And so when I, you know, I do what I do for the people who didn't come back, but, you know, I don't like this thing. It's not a good memory for me. It's a horrible memory. And I have Jeremiah Workman's words in my mind. I don't want this thing. I don't need this thing. All I want is those two guys back. And he doesn't even refer to it as the Navy Cross. And so anyway, so but again, it's starting with the truth. To me, I'm coming. I believe that if you'll tell Marines the truth, and I think you have to tell it to them as they come into the Marine Corps. This is the path that you've projected yourself down, and this is what you're going to deal with. And you can do it. The DNA that brought you in here, that will help you survive these different things, can take you through there. But you're going to need help, and you can't be afraid to ask for that. And here's what I the reason I talk about you when I do post-traumatic winning, and I draw a parallel. Sledge's life changes. You know, the book With the Old Breed starts out as 1,000 handwritten pages that he gets up and writes at night when he's having his nightmares. His wife ultimately types it. At first, he would not allow her to go near it. And, you know, they were stacked up all over the house. I mean, I saw an interview with one of his kids, and the kid says, there was yellow tablets everywhere in our house. My dad, you know, numbered yellow tablets, right? Like 145, 263. And ultimately, he allows his wife into that. And that is a turning point in his life, where he allows somebody else into his world, and then he has a partner that is there with him throughout, and it changes his life and whatnot. And you have a parallel story in your life. Your life changes when you meet a woman who said she's not going to stick around for that, and you say that she knew that you needed to somehow articulate your story, and then you articulate not only your story, but the story of your unit, and it's completely changed your life, yes?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And so
to me,
those lessons about disclosure and about honesty are the ones we don't tell often enough. That, look, these guys came home hurt. I mean, they came home hurt, and I won't say broken, but they came home hurt and damaged. And you can live a great life. And, I mean, hopefully if we could do that, there wouldn't be 25 years between the time they came home and the time they kind of got pointed in the right direction. Maybe there might be a couple, or maybe one, or maybe 6 months, because they would know because we had told them. So, but I wanted to have you on today and ask you if you had thoughts about why. So, estranged from their culture, dealing with the moral injury that they've suffered, and then not really sure how to reintegrate.
Right, well, sure. And I you know, and it's, you know, it depends on the individual, certainly. I would suspect that a lot of the men I served with have been moments in their life have at least thought about the process of ending your life, you know, whether you choose to or not, and why and what, and, you know, what are the ramifications, you know. The one thing that I've noticed for people that do it, it's, you know, I understand why people commit suicide, but it, you know, their family never gets reconciled to it. So,
right.
So it's like in some ways, it's like maybe a cop-out. I don't know. Like I say, when I thought about it, it didn't take me long to figure out, I can't see it on the road there. But you certainly, when you're in that moment, you're feeling like I was, that nobody gave a shit about me, and my experience meant nothing to anybody, and certainly not to me, as anything positive in my life. You know, your life's not positive. You're not, you know, what you have done has added no value to you or to anybody else. I think that's kind of I think back on where those moments where I was thinking, that was how I saw myself.
Do you think there's value Would there have been value to you of, you know, guys who had gone back down that path telling you about that path? That, hey,
Yeah. You know, forewarned is forearmed in some regard. And, yeah. You know, I mean, I remember the DIs and boot camps. I thought, you know, you're going to all be dead within a year. But we thought they were joking, you know. So.
We didn't realize there was a fair amount of truth. And
yeah, you know, just being assholes and, you know, how they are. So, I mean, so.
You know,
anyway,
last night I was watching something about the Eastern Front, and there's three different documentaries about each one of the army groups, the German army groups that goes into Germany. I'd never seen them before, so I watched them. And the most interesting part that I thought was I saw some you know videos that I've never seen before, but I heard they did drop-ins of German soldiers' interviews they did after the war. And they talk about, you know, we were indoctrinated as kids. We didn't know what we were being prepared for. And we went off to war, you know, into the Soviet Union in May of 1941, May, June of 1941. And those few of us who survived, I mean, we were just horribly used and spent by our country. And then, you know, we spent 10 years in captivity. On top of 4 years fighting it in Russia, and I'm fortunate to survive, and every one of us tells this improbable tale of how fate would intervene, and you know, my tank got blown up, and I got stuck, my boot got stuck, everybody jumped out of the tank and run one way, and was machine gunned down, because my boot got stuck, I didn't get out right away, and then I ran the other way, and I survived. And they tell, you know, but it's just, there, you hear their story, and they're coming to grips with the experience. And I don't know, the more I do what I do now, I think of guys like you, Ken, I think of the experience, and I think we do a great job turning them into warriors. But, you know, if we're honest with them, right, as you said, forewarned is forearmed. This is going to be just as much of the experience as the march to glorious. That isn't glorious. There's going to be an attempt to return to quote-unquote normal that is going to be every bit as formidable as the march to glory is going to be. And you need to be prepared for that, too. And so,
yeah, I think that's good. But as a kind of a ancillary comment, it's interesting to me that you went to NCRD and have been accepted down there by the people that are in authority as having something useful to say. I mean, I think that's... Are you talking to recruits or are you talking to guys that come back?
No, I was talking. I spoke with the majority of the permanent personnel. All the drill instructors were there. The students in DI school, all the support personnel, were all there. And there was a fair amount of discussion. Is there a way that we can get a version of this in front of recruits? Because we've never heard anything like this, and the positive message that we can do this, right? But nobody's ever talked to us like this about this kind of stuff before. I mean, we've had classes about don't kill yourself, but we've never had it stuck in our face and heard audio from this dude, Ken Rogers, who talks about coming home and drinking a case of beer and either a bottle of wine or a half a fifth of whiskey and doing that for years on end, and then quitting cold turkey, and then his life changes. And we haven't had that shoved in our face yet. And so, wow. So, no, yeah.
And I would think that it would be really interesting to sit down in some kind of planning meeting with some DIs, because, shit, they're the guys that make it happen. I mean, you know, the Corps has their principles and what they want that, but the DI is a guy that, you know, he's the man that molds these people into, you know, fighting machines. That would be really interesting to sit down and talk to them about that stuff.
Right, because
they think.
Nobody ever gets over that experience, and so to have some, and I, one of the things I talk about in the presentation is When I talk about the fifth commandment, the third commandment, which is you're not going to get over this, I talk about my Gunny. I talk about the power of what he said to me when he looked at me the day of a helicopter crash where four Marines were killed. And he looked at me and said, you know you're never going to get over this. And after I told him to fuck off, right, he looked at me and said, I said the F word to him, I think, I don't know, about 10 times. I told him to get the fuck away from me. And then I said, who told you that? And he said, Vietnam guys. Now, that's as far as that conversation went that day. Single best piece of advice anybody's ever given me in my life. Because whenever this shit bothers me, I know that there's nothing wrong with me because my company Gunny told me. Somebody who I respected, somebody who I worked with on a daily basis, and to this day think the world of. The power of that, as you're talking about. And a lot of that is embodied in our drill instructors, right? Superman, superwomen.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're the first guy you see when you walk through the door of the NCRD, and you don't like them, but, you know, they're the men that mold you into, and women that mold you into Marines.
Right.
I do.
Right.
The guys that I had for DIs, the force of their personalities were so powerful that I think about those bastards all the time. I do. I think about them all the time. I mean, I remember them. I remember their faces. I remember how they walked and how they walked different and how they were different and how they were all the same and what they told me. I mean, they told me shit that has marked me for life. And so, I mean, this is a powerful individual
right, in
the making of a Marine.
Right. And now,
be a great, and to have that guy kill 90 turds sitting in a room, you know, you're never going to get over some of this shit, you see. And when you see it and it bothers you later, there's nothing wrong with you.
Right.
It's just the way it is.
It's just the way it is. And anybody who tells you there's something wrong with you, you tell them to fuck off.
That's right.
And you tell them Staff Sergeant Umpty Frat says fuck right off. And no, but the power of that is when it does happen years later, right? That memory comes to, and it is like it was for me. It is a strong, warm memory of somebody who's told you the truth, and it influences your behavior. I know I can do this. He told me it would be this way, and that we all walk this path, and I know I can do it. So, interesting.
Right.
All right, sir. How are things in Idaho?
Well, they're hot. So it's warm here. But other than that, everything's going good. We're staying out of trouble. We stay busy. That's all I can say. How about you?
How's the bird watching?
Oh, I have not had much time to do that.
I can't tell you how wonderful my job is. I've got a whole bunch of email today after doing it last week. People that want to talk, people that want to say thank you. I can't do it often enough, and it's just a life-changing experience. And I want to thank you because every time I do it, I look at you in that punk-ass picture of you with your arm on a bunch of sandbags outside of a sandbag bunker in Quezon. Looking like an asshole, right? That?
I was.
And I hear the words you say, words to the effect that, you know, you can rightly say that if you have PTSD and you drink, you're an asshole. You're an asshole. I know I was. I drank. I hurt people's feelings. And I didn't give a shit. And the effect that has on people, right, is interesting, and it has an effect every time because it's in a sequence of my sister talking about drinking and what it did to her life, and a couple other guys, Jeremiah Workman, Navy Cross guy, an Army sergeant who lost both his brothers, and they were all going to farm together, and now he farms alone. And you're the fourth person in that sequence, and I hear it every time, and I watch the effect. And then at the end of it, you say, because you have to understand, I was drinking, you know, a case of beer and a bottle of wine at night, or a half a fifth of whiskey. And people are like, holy shit. And I said, yeah, he didn't do that for 2 weeks either. You know, he did it for years. And so you don't have to believe me about drinking, right, and trauma and PTSD. So, and if this was only 100% true, I wouldn't bother you with it. It's 1,000% true. And then I say, and I know there's people out there thinking, fuck you, old dude, I ain't going to give up my booze. And I said, and that's fine. But someday you're going to come to a crossroads in your life. Choose wisely, because there's a greater life out there waiting for you. And I say, Ken Rogers is emblematic of it. And so is, you know, Eugene Sledge, who came back home broken and fucked up. And if you watch that scene in the Pacific at the end, when he goes to his knees when his father wants him to go hunting, he's trying to deal with that pain. And it's not working out. And he's drinking, and he doesn't talk about it. And what changes his life? He begins to write. And he lets his wife into that world. And then his kids read it. And it fundamentally transforms his life over time. And I said, so the examples are out there for us, and you're one of them. So I love your story. I commend you for it. I commend you for sharing it and doing what you're doing. Thanks for coming on this morning and doing this.
You bet. You just keep on getting out there and spreading the word.
I will. All right, bud. Thank you.
All right, sir.
Yeah. All right, bye. That is the one and only personal friend of mine, Ken Rogers. Bravo. You can find it on right now. You can go watch it on Amazon Prime for free. That's right. You can. Yeah, bravo. Common man, uncommon valor. And, no, he's a no bullshit, awesome dude. Let me read you a couple emails. So I tune in this morning. I hear you say General Mattis isn't coming on, and I'm thinking, okay, he's going to throw this thing called the four in there. And then what happens? After two of the four, I'm riveted. Well done, Mac. Well done. Thank you. No, I mean, the kind of people that I've met who, when we talk about an issue like this, more suicide after we come home than killed in action in combat. How the fuck can that happen? And the guys that I know, you've heard four of them today. There's a whole lot more than them, but they're good ones. You know? These are the answers that Bob Nielsen. Guilt and a lack of training in how do we handle this. Tim Lynch. I can't read my own writing. A lack of a connection and a letdown when we stop doing something that we enjoy. Alex Hollings. We lose a sense of purpose. We lose the structure around us. We lose a sense of accountability that we live with. And we lose our identity. And we live in a culture that will open a doorway so that you can be a victim. All of that leads to a bad play. And then Ken Rogers, you come home to a culture you're estranged from, and you're dealing with a moral injury that is difficult for many of us to deal with. Let me tell you this, though. The more I do this, the more I think all this is preventable. I would say all of it. When you look at this, let me see if I can play a video for everybody that I play in the presentation. So don't touch that dial. Give me 1 second. Steve Winwood. Back in the high. Again. Okay, I want you to listen to about a minute of this, all right? So, all right, Steve, you need to cool your jets. So there's going to be some people that have infrastructure, substantial infrastructure damage. But I want you to listen to this. This is a doctor by the name of Trivedi. And he and his partner, a guy named Patel, are doing work. They're from India. They're doing work relative to depression. And the study that they're doing is in Texas. 44,000 people in the study. And they are the patients of general practitioners that participate in this study about depression. And so listen to the numbers, okay? Listen to the percentages of people that test positive on three or more occasions for symptoms of depression, and then listen to the percent that ultimately go see a mental health professional. Hopefully this works.
So one thing, at the end of this exercise today, and maybe in the next 2-3 years, I want all of you to be actually as informed as Julie is about all this. She is absolutely right. So
this is Dr. Trivedi.
Our screening is really universal screening. If you, what traditionally happens in primary care is people wait, and the patient either complains or starts crying or is suicidal is when they screen. That is not called screening, because then it's too late. So what this is, we are primary care practices are universally screening. Every patient coming into the clinic gets screened for depression, and that is how you identify whether they need to have further monitoring or not. And that is the 12 to 15% of patients. Once they get screened positive, then they get routine measurement at every treatment occasion to monitor their outcomes. And if the patients have significant need for psychiatry, they are referred, and that has been really less than 1% of the population. Because there is, like...
All right, so if you heard that, all right, if you heard that, there's Steve Winward again. All right, that means we're leaving. But if you heard that, what that means is the vast majority of us are just struggling with those things that come from life. There is a percentage of the population that has infrastructure damage and, you know, has more issues than simply learning how to handle the issue. Okay? And so they have to be treated, albeit in a different way. So, as I look at this, you know, the majority of people can do this. If you give them the right information, if you give them the right kind of resources, they can get through it. I don't think we do a good job of it. But that's changing, so that's exciting. Anyway, thanks for listening today on a Monday. Don't touch that dial. You're going to hear about my weekend. You're going to hear about how funny I think Bernie Sanders is. Right? Once he started paying people minimum wage, he had to lay them off. And he used to make comments of, no effect on the economy. Oh, they're making all this money. It impacted his campaign a little bit different. We'll also talk about the Marine Corps under General Berger has changed its requirement that has been in stone for a while, and that is the requirement for 38 ship amphibious Navy to move 2 MEVs. That was the requirement. General Berger said that is no longer a requirement for us. We will find a whole variety of ways to get to the fight. So we'll talk about that. And then in the second hour that just concluded, which is longer than a second hour, it was actually about an hour and 45 minutes. You'll hear Bob Nielsen, Tim Lynch, Alex Hollings, and Ken Rogers talk about their thoughts on why do we have more suicide in many units? Why do we have more suicide now than killed in action in that unit? We lost 6 guys in combat. We've lost 10 since we've been home, and what their thoughts were about that on a Monday. Have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and out.